This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.
Informed sources say that Tehran is still steadying the U.S. response to its amendments made to the EU proposal for the revival of the JCPOA. Two U.S. warships sailing through the Taiwan Strait, and that amid tensions with Beijing over the recent visits by American delegations to Taiwan. And Afghans marking 1 year since a U.S. airstrike that killed 10 civilians, including 7 children. We'll bring you a report from Kabul. I'm Behrouz Najafi. It's good to have you with us. Now, beginning with our top story, a detailed examination of the U.S. response to Iran's amendments to a European Union draft proposal for the revival of the 2015 deal is going on here in Tehran at an expert level. According to Noor News, affiliated with the Supreme National Security Council, the process is expected to last until Friday. Washington offered its response earlier this week. Tehran says it will convey its final thoughts through the EU coordinator after a thorough examination. The deal was thrown into chaos when the U.S. unilaterally withdrew from it in 2018 and reimposed sanctions. Since last year, Iran, the remaining signatories, have held multiple rounds of talks to revive the accord, with the U.S. involved indirectly. Iran has demanded a strong and durable deal that includes sanctions relief and economic guarantees. Israeli settlers have once again stormed the Al-Aqsa Mosque compound in the occupied East Al-Quds, a move seen as provocative by Palestinians. That was carried out hours ago under the protection of the military. The settlers performed religious rituals in the courtyards of the mosque. For years, Israeli officials have been allowing settler incursions into the compound. Palestinians consider the practice as part of Israeli plans for the Judaization of the Al-Aqsa Mosque. Non-Muslim prayers are prohibited at the site under an agreement between Israel and Jordan, the custodian of the holy site. Last year, Israeli violence against Palestinian worshippers at the mosque led to an 11-day war with resistance groups in Gaza. Around 260 Palestinians were killed in that conflict. Palestinians in the blockaded Gaza Strip have attended the Friday prayers before the Red Cross office to show solidarity with Palestinian prisoners. Last Monday, Palestinian prisoners started protesting their inhumane detention conditions. Ashraf Shannon reports.
Hundreds of people attended the Friday prayer in front of the Red Cross office in the Gaza Strip in a move to express their sympathy and unity with Palestinian prisoners inside Israeli jails and detention centers. They came to drum up support for Palestinian prisoners who kicked off a series of protests last Monday against persistent mistreatment inside regime jails. The event is part of the Friday of Rage in solidarity with Palestinian detainees. During the Friday sermon, Hamas movement warned the Israeli regime against harming Palestinian prisoners.
Our military wings, including the Qassam and Quds brigades, and the military wings of all Palestinian resistance factions, are all united behind the prisoners. We will spare no effort to secure the release of the prisoners. Harming Palestinian prisoners is an attack on all Palestinian resistance factions.
Over the past 4 days, Palestinian detainees held in 24 Israeli prisons have refused to take part in security checks and returned their meals. They also organized sit-ins in prison yards as part of their protest action.
The Israeli prison service reneged on understandings that were previously reached with prisoners' representatives. It imposed punitive measures, including moving tens of detainees to solitary confinement, preventing inmates from going to the prison yard, and banning prisoners from meeting their families. In response to this, the Palestinian prisoners have declared the state of general mobilization last Monday.
In recent weeks, the Israeli prison service increased its oppressive measures against Palestinian prisoners by imposing double isolation on some detainees. Observers say the Palestinian prisoners have become propaganda material for candidates in Israel's elections.
Palestinian prisoners are escalating their actions because they demand better detention conditions. The suffering of Palestinian prisoners increases every time the Israeli regime plans to hold elections. Israeli officials are using the oppression of prisoners as part of their election campaigns.
Currently, there are some 5,000 Palestinian detainees in Israeli prisons, and that figure includes women and children. According to prisoners' advocacy groups, the Israeli regime has detained more than 1 million Palestinians since the Nakba in 1948 under the watchful eye of the international community. Ashraf Shanan, Gaza.
China is reacting to U.S. warships sailing through the Taiwan Strait as tensions keep simmering between the two sides. Navy cruisers Chancellorsville and Antietam are currently in the region. China's military says it's monitoring the vessels while maintaining a high alert and readiness to defeat any provocation. This is the first time that U.S. vessels are sailing through the strait since tensions escalated early this month over House Speaker Pelosi's visit to Taiwan. China reacted by launching unprecedented military drills near the island. Taiwan also conducted its own drills. Beijing considers Taiwan as part of its territories. It says Washington is stirring separatist sentiments in Taiwan with diplomatic exchanges and arms sales. Africans are marking 1 year since a U.S. air raid that killed 10 civilians, including 7 kids. The attack took place amid Washington's messy withdrawal from Afghanistan and the end of its 20-year military campaign in that country. Our correspondent has a report from Kabul.
The final act of terror by the U.S. before ending its 20-year occupation of Afghanistan was targeting a civilian car with a missile and killing 10 members of a family last year. 2-year-old Somaya was the youngest, and 6 other victims were under 18. 3 adults were also among the fatalities. This deadly strike took place by the U.S. forces amid their evacuation following the Taliban's return to power.
We heard a very terrifying sound. We were running like crazy to get there. We saw a car burning in fire. People were killed. There was a lot of smoke and people were screaming. The U.S. said there was ISIS in that house, but later they confessed they were all civilians.
So, were there others killed? Yes.
U.S. officials tried so hard not to utter the word civilians at first, but later they confessed that the strike was a mere mistake, taking the lives of 10 innocent people.
And acknowledge our mistakes.
The last memory from U.S. presence in Afghanistan is the drone strike that killed 7 children. During their presence, the Americans conducted thousands of similar operations, killing countless civilians. They use this attack to turn the media away from their shameful pullout. They do such actions by breaking legal and international standards. This was a war crime, and the perpetrators should have been tried.
According to the Bureau of Investigative Journalism, more than 900 civilians have been killed in the U.S. airstrike since 2015 in Afghanistan. And so far, no one has been held accountable. The drone strike that took the lives of 7 children and 3 adults showed once more that the victims of the U.S. missions are mostly innocent civilians. Abdullah Hamirzadeh from Kabul.
Now over to Pakistan. The country has been grappling with monsoon flooding that has swept much of that country. Officials say the death toll has surpassed the 1,000 mark since mid-June. 119 people have died in just one day. The government has declared an emergency and mobilized the military. Thousands of residents in critical areas have been ordered to evacuate. Pakistan is calling for international assistance to cope with the aftermath of the natural disaster. Authorities say that this year's monsoon flooding has affected more than 33 million people. Nearly 1 million homes have been destroyed or badly damaged. Well, I talked to our correspondent, and Nasser Kazemi says that the extent of the flooding in Pakistan is so huge that the government is not able to cope with it.
The scale of disaster is so high, that's why the government is confused on how to deal with such a situation. The infrastructures have been destroyed in the fresh wave of the floods in the past 24 hours. And the National Disaster Management Authority of Pakistan is warning of more floods in next 48 hours. And the rains are continued in the areas where these floods are taking place. And as far as the government efforts are concerned, government is trying its best to reach out those people who are stranded in the floodings in Khyber Pakhtunkhwa province, in Balochistan province, as well as in Sindh province. But reaching on those places, reaching on those sites is very difficult for the government officials and the rescue workers. There were pledges from different neighboring countries, including the Iranian president, Sayyid Ibrahim Raisi, called Pakistani Prime Minister Shehbaz Sharif last night. Both leaders discussed the overall situation after the flooding in Pakistan. Iranian president assured all of his country's support to help Pakistan in such circumstances.
Well, it was a bombshell, still very hard to comprehend. Britain announced a whopping 80% increase in electricity and gas bills. The immediate question that comes to mind is how the people are going to afford that. Britons are already suffering a cost of living crisis, which only appears to worsen with no relief in the near future.
It has been a rocky economic road that the Brits are traveling on, which continues to chip away at their income. Some were questioning how they would manage their expenses in the UK these days. Why, with an unprecedented inflation and a cost of living crisis, now their nightmare has gotten worse. An 80% increase in electric and gas bills have been announced, one that is coming before the winter season.
It is a major problem because what is happening, of course, is first of all, real incomes are falling because people are not getting wage settlements in line with inflation, but below inflation. Then tax burden has increased, you know, to record levels as well. The government has been raising taxes to pay for the furlough scheme and all the money that they splurged.
To be exact, an 80% increase would mean that it would average about £3,600, or about $4,200 per year from October. And this is terrible news, especially for the poor and the ones at the bottom half of the social strata.
And of course, being winter, it's going to affect us more. I mean, in the summer when it went up, it wasn't too bad because we don't use a lot of gas or electric in the summer.
It just has to be a change in lifestyle at this point, you know, just turning on the gas when you can, when it's really necessary, or making sure that all the lights are definitely turned off and so forth.
The UK was suffering already from high energy prices, in particular heating bills, even before the Ukraine crisis began. So bad was the situation that fuel poverty, as it was called, was leading to deaths for people who could not afford to heat their homes.
If you're poor, you spend more money on energy and food. And so these people are being disproportionately hit. Many of them have already got debt and they don't have any savings to dip into. So it is a crisis. There's no question about that.
These are the stats that are truly shocking that one would not expect from a European country. For example, this article in 2020 pointed out to how thousands of people in the UK died from the cold and that fuel poverty was to blame. On average, there were 32,000 more deaths between December and March than the rest of the year. Many perished because of the refusal of a society with abundant wealth and resources to provide for its most vulnerable citizens. An average of 9,700 deaths each year were believed to be caused by living in a cold house.
We know we need to do more because actually the most vulnerable households have no cushion, have nothing available to them. So what I'm looking at is how I can target that help for those people, not just to January.
Well, the price increase in energy bills will likely push millions into not just fuel poverty, but poverty. The British government is now facing the unprecedented task of figuring out how to help people with their heating bills. And that in addition to a rise in the number of people applying for government assistance programs. In the meantime, many are joining a campaign calling for a stop to paying energy bills.
The unprecedented hike for energy prices in the UK will surely affect the UK's economy. One obvious outcome of this price increase is that it will chip away at people's spending power and income. This is while people's income has not kept pace with the inflation rate. Increases have been minimal or not at all. This may explain why there have been so many strikes and protests recently in different sectors in the UK. The latest, the postal worker strike. 115,000 workers across 1,500 locations. Criminal barristers and mass rail strikes have also plagued the UK, as the country is battling a historic cost of living crisis. The outgoing Prime Minister Boris Johnson has sure left an economic mess for the next administration to deal with. But was it all his fault? The UK did not have a sound economy even before the pandemic started.
Of course, we could see this coming, and that's why we've put the steps in place that we already have. And don't forget that although there will be more announcements next month, more cash coming from September onwards, you shouldn't forget that the pipeline of cash stretches out throughout the autumn.
We don't know who the next administration will be. Will it be Liz Truss? Will it be Rishi Sunak? But what we do know is they're both incompetent.
Among the group of G7 economies, the UK has suffered the highest inflation rate than any other G7 country, as price rises have reached a 40-year record, with inflation recorded at 10.1% in the year for the month of July. That is the highest since the year 1982. And with the Ukraine crisis showing no signs of ending, the future looks bleak for the country, especially since the new administration will not officially begin work until October. And Boris Johnson's view on this, the new administration will clearly have to help people with energy bills.
That I know that even if things can sometimes seem dark now,
that's a wrap for this news bulletin. Goodbye.
Fruitful Moments with IRIB English Radio. Log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullah.
Selection of Ayatollah Khamenei's viewpoints.
Hame ba wujood ghudde saratani Israel mukhalifin.
All of us are opposed to the cancer's tumor, Israel.
Wajh mushtarak hame wahdat ummat islami.
Unity of Islamic Ummah is the aspect that all of Islamic denominations have in common.
The following is a part of the speech delivered by Imam Khamenei, the leader of the Islamic Revolution, in a meeting with Friday prayer leaders from across the country in the Imam Khomeini Hosseiniya on July 27, 2022.
As for the position that the Friday prayers hold, let me tell you in one word that the Friday prayer is a totally unique religious duty and there's nothing like it. One feature is that the Friday prayer connects and ties together two essential factors that are part of a pure life. What are these two factors? One is the remembrance of God, dhikr. The other is the presence of the people. We shall reward him with a good life. Quran, Surah 16, verse 97. Now, the good life has pillars. These two pillars, however, are among its most important pillars. One is to turn your attention toward God, the aspect that religious scholars call being in contact with God. The other aspect is the gathering and presence of the people. These two aspects exist together in the Friday prayers. This is also the case in some other obligations and religious duties. But when we add the rest of the features to it, we see that the Friday prayer is exceptional. So, as I mentioned, these two characteristics exist together in the Friday prayer. We have both, O you who have faith, and hurry towards the remembrance of Allah. The Quran, Surah 62, verse number 9. It's both prayer and it's a Jumu'ah. Prayer is pure remembrance of God, and Jumu'ah is the gathering of people. That is, this is one of those features, and perhaps it is the first special feature of the Friday prayer. Secondly, this collective remembrance of God allows the blessings and effects of the dhikr to descend upon the people. The remembrance of Allah has effects, which have been referred to in the Quran. The hearts find rest in Allah's remembrance. The Quran, Surah 13, verse 28. This is spread throughout the Friday prayer, when everyone remembers Allah together. At one time, remembering the noble verse, hold fast all together to Allah's cord and do not be divided. Quran, Surah 3, verse 103.
دنیای اسلام یک
The world of Islam has one single prescription today, and that is unity. This prescription exists in all Islamic countries. Nations should be united.
I mentioned that even holding fast to God's cord must be done all together. Hold fast all together to Allah's court. We all have to hold fast to God's court together. This gathering in Islam is something extraordinary. The community spirit and presence of the people is an important matter. This is where you need to be careful. If, for example, your Friday prayer this week has fewer attendees than last month's Friday prayer, you should be worried.
Allah, I wanna thank you. I wanna thank you. Things that you've done for me through all my years I've been lost. You guided me from all the ways that were wrong. Indeed, you gave me hope. Oh, Allah, I wanna thank you. I wanna thank you for all the things that you've done.
Wildfires in Greece, Turkey, the United States.
Palestinian prisoners in Israeli jails continue to engage in hunger strikes.
Kim Yo-jong, the powerful sister of North Korean leader.
On the news line.
The army of the Islamic Republic of Iran has staged a massive drill which features scores of cutting-edge reconnaissance and combat drones. The drill covers the strategic waters of the Persian Gulf and the Sea of Oman, as well as the country's central regions. Over 150 new advanced drones are flown in the drill. The Army's 1401 joint drone exercise involves units from the Ground Force, Navy, Air Force and Air Defense Force. The units have already carried out their intelligence gathering and patrol missions. They include homegrown Yasir, Sadegh, Yazdan and Ababil 3 tactical surveillance unmanned aerial vehicles. Pelican vertical takeoff and landing naval drone, as well as Muhajir 6, were also flown from different bases. Muhajir 6 is an ISTAR drone, which means the drone can operate intelligence, surveillance, target acquisition, and reconnaissance missions. It can significantly boost Iran's capability in confronting threats. The drill features the Army's latest achievements in drone engineering and production. Due to the expansion of unmanned aerial capabilities, execution of various and numerous drone missions, and the need to coordinate such flights, the Army has set up a command and control network for the drone operations. The exercise exhibits only a small fraction of the achievements made by the Islamic Republic of Iran's army.
Iran has for some time now shown that it is a world leader in drone technology, both in terms of indigenous capabilities developed by Iranian industries and the reverse engineering that Iran has done off of some of the United States frontline drones, which Iran has acquired one way or another. But it's not just the technology, it's how it's adapted for the modern battlefield.
This is the first time that a joint drone exercise is conducted at the level of the four forces of the Islamic Republic of Iran's army and the country's joint air defense base. Iranian military experts and technicians have in recent years made substantial headways in manufacturing a broad range of indigenous equipment, making the armed forces self-sufficient in the armed sphere.
And so it's drones and the technology and the tactics are adapted to these realities. And so, it's one thing, though, to have theoretical knowledge. It's another to have practical. And these exercises, I think, take Iran's drones and allows the Iranian military to practice using these drones in realistic scenarios that will make these drones more effective if Iran is ever called upon to use them in a conflict.
Iran says it has become an exporter of military drones in the world and that the country holds the upper hand in aerospace. Back in July, when U.S. President Joe Biden was visiting the West Asia region, Iran's army unveiled its first division of ships and submarines capable of carrying armed drones.
It's the height of hypocrisy, hubris-based hypocrisy, for the United States, Israel, or any Western nation that incorporates drone technology into their operations to call out Iran for developing their own drone capability and employing these drones in support of Iranian backed actions in the region. The United States invented the armed drone, and the United States has used armed drones extensively throughout its involvement in the Middle East and Central Asia and elsewhere.
Earlier this year, Iran's new combat drone called Gaza successfully passed flight tests and became fully operational. The vehicle has a 21-meter wingspan and a 3,100-kilogram takeoff mass with the capability of carrying a payload of 500 kilograms. And before that, Iran's Islamic Revolution Guards Corps unveiled one of its new kamikaze drones, dubbed Mirage 504, which is specialized in attacking enemies' defense systems. The Islamic Republic's military doctrine holds that the country's armed capability solely serves defensive purposes and poses no threat to other states.
The United States is increasing its belligerence in Syria by launching airstrikes on the country. On Tuesday, the U.S. has carried out airstrikes on a camp in Deir ez-Zor in eastern Syria, claiming the area and the infrastructure there were used by Iran's Islamic Revolution Guards Corps. Iran rejected the allegation as baseless, saying they were a breach of Syria's sovereignty.
And you know, I'm not sure what's going on here, whether they were attacking them because they were afraid that they might be preparing to launch some kind of offensive against American troops in Iraq, or whether they were doing it just to to please Israel and to make Israel say, you know, look, even if we go back to the JCPOA, we're still going to be aggressive against Iran.
The U.S. claimed that the attack was in response to a mid-August drone strike on one of its bases in Syria. On Wednesday, the U.S. then launched more strikes in Deir ez-Zor, which were retaliated by rocket attacks against U.S. bases. Several U.S. servicemen were said to be injured in those rocket attacks. The U.S. military's Central Command, which oversees the American forces in the West Asia region, said in a statement that the aerial assault had been aimed at, quote, protecting U.S. forces from attacks. Deir ez-Zor is a strategic province in East Syria. It borders Iraq and contains vast oil fields. The U.S. forces entered that region in 2015 without the consent of the Syrian government.
The United States is occupying Syrian territory illegally and criminally. And the Syrian government has the right to have what host whatever it forces it wants on its territory. And the United States forces are going to be attacked. I don't know who's going to attack them or whether they'll be attacked, but certainly the Syrian government has the right to attack them and get them out of their country. But the United States doesn't feel it needs to provide proof to people. It presumes that when it says something, people will accept it because they have to.
Washington claimed that it wanted to prevent the oil fields from falling into the hands of terrorists, but it has now turned out that the occupying U.S. forces are plundering the country's rich resources. Just recently, Syrian news agency reported that U.S. military has smuggled crude oil from Syria to bases in Iraq. It was reported that a convoy of 122 tankers laden with oil from the energy-rich Jazeera region in Syria's northeastern province of Haska moved through the illegal Mahmoudiya border crossing into neighboring Iraq.
We've kept the oil. We stayed back and kept the oil. Other people can patrol the border of Syria, frankly, and Turkey, let them, they've been fighting for 1,000 years. Let them do the border. We don't want to do that. We want to bring our soldiers home. But we did leave soldiers because we're keeping the oil. I like oil. We're keeping the oil, and we're working with the Kurds, and we're frankly working with Turkey, and we're working with a lot of countries.
The U.S. is also running Al-Tanf military base in the Syrian province of Homs. The military base lies close to an intersection between the borders of Syria, Jordan, and Iraq, and has therefore a strategic importance. It is also the only U.S. military base not located in the areas held by Kurdish militants in the Arab country. It's believed the U.S. is using the base to train and support Daesh terrorists to use them for its own benefit.
They're occupying Syrian territories, they're stealing their oil, they're occupying the most productive agricultural territory, you know, and they have absolutely no right to do this. And they're doing it, and they've said they're doing it, in order to prevent the reconstruction of Syria. In order to keep Syria down economically and socially, and really in order to keep Syria weak and to keep alive the political project of replacing the Syrian government, replacing the Syrian regime, and breaking up the Syrian state, which they've had to put on hold, but they haven't given up.
Like waging attacks against the Syrian army or its allies. The U.S. has aligned itself with Kurdish forces in northern Syria, who took up arms against the Syrian government when the crisis started in the Arab country. But Syria's northern neighbor, Turkey, is not happy with the presence of Kurdish forces on its borders, whom Ankara views as terrorists. Turkey, which is a strong supporter of anti-Syria forces, is now considering a military action in northern Syria. That incursion would further complicate the situation in an already complex environment.
Daria Dugin, a journalist and prominent media personality sanctioned by the US and the UK, was massively pro-war, that she even wrote a book about it. But was she the target, or was her father? The two had been at a cultural festival together that afternoon. Alexander Dugin had given a lecture. Similar to many of his lectures, this one was no exception and was fully in line with his views. While many believe Dugin dreamt of a new Russian Empire, others said they heard echoes of these ideas during some of Russian president's speeches, including the one about Russia's special military operation in Ukraine. Saturday's incident was first witnessed by the world through unverified video footage showing Dugin at the scene of his daughter's death. Soon after, Russian Federal Security Service said the car bombing was orchestrated and carried out by Ukrainian secret services. Kiev has, on the other hand, denied the claim, saying it had nothing to do with the incident. But whether Ukraine was behind the attack or not, Russia is bound to respond to the true perpetrators of the attack, and the question remains, what kind of response can the world expect from Moscow?
Well, Russia's responses have been fairly targeted so far. They have a type of Iraq invasion in their military operations, but I believe that they will, based on their history of the last 6 months, probably respond by attacking some of the intelligence and military centers in Ukraine, perhaps in Kiev.
Saturday's bombing has left not only Russia but the world with many unanswered questions. The target is said to have been Dugin, known for his fiery rhetoric and hawkish anti-Western stance. Western media has painted him as a driving force behind key aspects of President Vladimir Putin's foreign policy. However, despite his reputation in the West, in Russia he has never enjoyed official endorsement from the Kremlin and is largely considered a marginal figure. Earlier on Saturday evening, Dugin was giving a lecture at a family festival on the outskirts of Moscow. Unconfirmed reports say Dugin initially planned to leave the festival with his daughter, who was also attending the event, but later decided to take a separate car, while Daria took his car. The question as to why he or his daughter was targeted using such drastic measures remains.
Well, Alexander Dugin is a philosopher who is also a Russian nationalist, and he has some internationalist views which coincide with many of Russia's allies these days. But his daughter also, Daria, let's not forget, was a journalist, a reporter with her own voice. She'd been in liberated Mariupol, for example. So it's not clear exactly, for example, whether Alexander was being targeted or Daria in her own right was being targeted, because apparently her car was targeted and that was not one that her father used. So it's a little difficult to say exactly what the motivation was, but they're clearly, from the gloating, from the glee, from US official sources, including Voice of America, Radio Free Europe, for example, and from many of the extremist Ukrainians, it's clear that they were very happy with this young woman being murdered by a terrorist bombing in Moscow.
It is widely believed that the war in Ukraine is causing a global food crisis. But how could this be true? Ukraine is one of the world's biggest exporters of green essentials, like wheat and corn. But most of its products can't even leave the country. This is causing serious problems in places where they depend most on this supply, like the Middle East and Africa. There's so many ripple effects from the war, but it's hard to overstate just how big the impact of the grain crisis is. Along with the shortages, you've also got the rising prices of fertilizers and fuel, as well as natural disasters due to climate change like drought, which has only further worsened the situation globally. And now UN Secretary General Antonio Guterres has warned of a global food crisis, as the West's anti-Russia stance is creating obstacles to the flow of Russian products and fertilizers to the world. Guterres said that the global food crisis triggered by the Ukraine conflict looms over the world. The UN chief says the West's sanctions on Russia have exacerbated the poor situation of the global economy.
They are trying to use all kinds of arguments. Some are, real, based on something. Some are absolutely spurious and based on nothing, to somehow get the public opinion against Russia. And that concerns this story of grain. You know, Russia and other countries produce, much more grain than Ukraine. So the very idea that Africa will somehow starve not because of misguided Western policies, not because of the prices which, you know, West commands, but because five boats of grain which cannot leave Odessa. It's a joke. There were tons of possibilities for even that grain to go, and there is endless amount of possibilities to get grain from Russia, from France, and so on. So that was all mobilized by Ukraine to somehow turn the opinions that it's like all Russia fault. You know, children are dying in Africa, Russian fault, isn't it? And unfortunately, Antonio Guterres, rather than approaching the whole thing objectively, coming to the, you know, to the territory, exploring it, asking questions, saying, what can we do? He more or less channels the information which is given to him by Ukraine.
But despite this, only a few nations seem to be pushing for diplomatic efforts in an attempt to restore the global supply chains, and other countries, mainly the US and its allies, continue their anti-Russia stance, pushing ahead with their foreign policy. The impact of the West's war on Russia through sanctions can be felt globally. Global supply chains have been disrupted, fears of food shortages are rising, and countries' economies have also taken a hit. But despite the heavy costs incurred by the people worldwide, the US and many European leaders seem to have set their eyes on pushing ahead with their sanctions policy instead of opting for diplomacy. Russia is a major exporter of potash, ammonia, urea, and other soil nutrients, and the supply of all these fertilizers, which are necessities for efficient production of corn, soy, rice, and wheat, has been heavily disrupted as a result of Western sanctions on Russia. A clear example of this would be Brazilian farmers, who are forced to use less fertilizers considering the shortages created in their country. In some African countries, farmers are reverting to using manure to nourish their crops. And in North America, some farmers have stockpiled fertilizers for the 2023 season in anticipation of higher prices. Meanwhile, in the United States, fertilizer bills are expected to jump 12% this year, and that's according to the American Farm Bureau Federation and the U.S. Department of Agriculture, USDA data.
No, I think the whole war is definitely, you know, war in general is, should be avoided. But this one is just very cynical calculation. Somehow the leadership of NATO, leadership in Washington, decided that it's a win-win situation. A, we, you know, get opinion against Russia. B, we'll get sanctions against Russia, which will benefit us, our gas companies, our oil companies, our military companies. And see, it even has a chance to weaken Russia, which is like our enemy, to weaken Russia militarily. So they're pumping Ukraine with military forces. They're trying to push them to the battlefield. In the battlefield, Russians are killed, Ukrainians are killed in great numbers, while, you know, leadership, Ukrainian leadership buys fancy cars for themselves and they don't send their children to the front. They send some poor people to the front. So this is just exercising the bloodshed, out of which many people hope to, you know, get some economic benefit.
But while standards of living in many countries have already deteriorated drastically in light of decisions made by policymakers, problems may further worsen in the future. Instead of following diplomacy similar to Turkey in an attempt to solve the ongoing crisis, the West continues to follow its warmongering aspirations and further sanction Russia.
IRIB English Radio. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
Questions and answers on Islamic beliefs.
Bismillahir Rahmanir Rahim. Assalamu alaikum to you, dear listeners of IRIB English Radio, Call of Islam page. This is Question and Answer on Islamic Beliefs. I'm Atta, the host of this program. With me in the studio is a guest speaker from the Islamic House of Qom, Hujjatul Islam Academy. Assalamu alaikum, Sheikh Karimi, and welcome to the program.
Wa alaikum assalam wa rahmatullah, and thank you for having me.
So for today's discussion, we want to talk about a personality during the history of Islam and whether he had a role through his judgments and through his decisions in assassinating and martyring Imam al-Hussein alayhi salam or not. He is no one but Shuraih ibn Haris al-Kindi, the famous Shuraih who was in position of the judgment from the time of we can say the first caliph of Islam up until Imam al-Hussein alayhi salam. So, Sheikh Karimi, let's start this episode. We're giving us just a background about this personality. I mean, Shuraih ibn Haris al-Kindi, who was he? And whether he had a role in martyring Imam al-Hussein alayhi salam or not.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. We do not have much information about the exact time for his birth. But it seems that he was born around the year 30 before the Hijrah of the Prophet. So somehow he is contemporary to Imam Ali alayhi salam. I mean, the year he is born is somehow like the year of the birth of Imam Ali alayhi salam. There are discussions about whether we need to include him among the companions of the Prophet or not. But the point is that all of us, we know Shuraih for being a judge.
Yes.
And as you rightly mentioned, for many years he was in the position of judgment. He was
Shuraih al-Qadi.
Shuraih al-Qadi.
Yes.
Especially from the time of the second caliph up until the year 78 after Hijrah. So for so many years, maybe for more than 50 years, he was in this position. So he continued to be judged at the time of the third caliph as well. And at the time of Imam Ali alayhi salam, he was in the same position for some times, which shows that maybe he was an expert in judging among the people.
Okay.
Although he had some mistakes, but yes. He was an expert in this regard, and that is why, for some periods, he is in the position of judgment when Imam Ali alayhi salam comes to power in the year 35 after Hijrah.
As you said, for his wrong decisions and judgments, he was even sent into exile by Imam Ali alayhi salam because of some of his wrong judgments, okay?
Yeah, exactly. So in some cases, we read in the history of Islam that Imam Ali alayhi salam is reproaching him and reprimanding him for some of his wrong judgment.
Yes.
And the other point is that some scholars believe that Imam Ali alayhi salam continued to accept Shuraih in this position, provided that the Imam Ali alayhi salam himself would be supervising all his judgments.
Yes.
As you rightly mentioned, he has some mistakes and he was somehow reprimanded by Imam Ali alayhi salam. He continued to be judged at the time of Imam al-Hasan alayhi salam, and also after Imam al-Hasan alayhi salam during the imamate of Imam al-Hussein alayhi salam. Now, when it comes to tragedy, to the tragedy of Karbala, some people believe that it was the fatwa, it was the verdict of Shuraih which caused the tragedy of Karbala to happen. And in his verdict, he asked the people to join the army of Yazid and to kill Imam al-Hussein alayhi salam. And this is the assumption of many people.
Or now, at least it was a religious backing and protection of the war of Yazid against Imam al-Hussein, okay?
Yeah. Let me read the text which is attributed to Shuraih. He says that, إن حسين بن علي بن أبي طالب شق عصى المسلمين وخالف أمير المؤمنين وخرج عن الدين. According to the attributed text to Shuraih Qazi, he says that Hussein, that is Imam Hussein alayhi salam, he has brought a difference among the Muslims, he has divided the nation, and he has rejected the commander of the faithful, referring to Yazid. He is somehow apostate. He's outside of the religion. This is confirmed before me. So, حَكَمْتُ بِدَفْعَهِ وَقَتْلِهِ.
Yes.
My verdict is that you need to, repel him and kill him. حِفْظًا لِشَرِيعَةِ سَيِّدِ الْمُرْسَلِينَ. Mm-hmm. To protect the religion of the Prophet.
Yes.
This is the verdict which is attributed to Shuraih, and we need to discuss whether it is an authentic attribution or not.
Questions and Answers on Islamic Beliefs on IRIB English Radio. You can send your questions to englishradio@irib.ir.
But before getting to Imam al-Hussein, Shuraih was, we can say, defamed for some of his decisions. For example, the story of the sons of Muslim ibn Aqil, because he was believed to be in custody of them, but leaving them. And then these two kids were martyred. Again, Hani ibn Urwa, you know, and the decision that he made by, letting them away from the palace of Ubaydullah ibn Ziyad. Then Ubaydullah ibn Ziyad find a chance to martyr Hani ibn Urwa, and also the bay'ah that he put with the great men of the Kufa. And after that, when Ubaydah all of a sudden comes to the Kufa, goes and pay allegiance to Ubaydullah. You know, he was defamed also by these decisions that he had made before giving fatwa against Imam al-Hussein.
Exactly. Thank you for sharing that. Shuraih, all in all, is a very, very negative personality because of his decisions.
Right.
And I think for many of us nowadays, he's a role model. As a person who is in power, as a person who is judged for many years.
Mm-hmm.
But, in critical moments
cases
and points,
moments, yes,
he has made very wrong decisions.
Yes.
As you rightly mentioned, he was supposed to be in custody of the children of Muslim.
Yes.
But just because he felt danger coming from Ubaydullah, he just left them.
Left the kids, that's
so,
right.
So, this is showing the reality of Shuraih,
yes,
the famous judge of that time, who was, judge for many years.
Okay.
As long as, he feels danger for his life, he just comes to follow the
yes
orders of the rulers of the
yes
time. And you mentioned about the bay'ah, about the allegiance of the elders of the city of Kufa, like Habib ibn Mazahir, Mukhtar Thaqafi, Umar ibn Sa'd. And this is interesting
yes
that we have Umar ibn Sa'd. They, in front of Shuraih, they promised to help Imam al-Hussein alayhi salam, and some of them, they invited Imam al-Hussein alayhi salam. But when they were threatened by Ubaydullah ibn Ziyad, one of the first people who, just broke their allegiance to Imam al-Hussein alayhi salam
yes
again was Shuraih. Not only that, he joins the court of Ubaydullah and
mm-hmm
becomes one of the advisors of Ubaydullah ibn Ziyad.
Yes.
Now imagine, before this time, you are inviting Imam al-Hussein alayhi salam. People come to you
yes
to show their allegiance to Imam al-Hussein alayhi salam.
Yes.
And suddenly you are threatened. You feel danger
mm-hmm
for your life. You see your life in danger. And you just change, 180
yes
degrees.
Yes.
This is the reality, the real personality of Shuraih.
Very, very much recalling me of the behaviors of the Kufans
mm-hmm
who sent letter to Imam al-Hussein alayhi salam. We back you. More than 12,000 letters, as they say, were sent to Imam al-Hussein to invite him to come to the Kufa. But all of a sudden,
they
left their protection.
Most of them did not join Imam al-Hussein
yes
alayhi salam, neither they joined the army of Abdullah. But
yes
when it comes to Shuraih, he has a very
yeah
great role in advising and helping Abdullah ibn Ziyad.
Okay.
And this is very unfortunate about him.
Mm-hmm.
So, as I mentioned, this is for sure that we are talking about a very negative personality who has made such wrong decisions in critical moments. But when it comes to these fatwa and verdict that I shared the text, we do not have any authentic source for it.
Yes.
So although we are talking about such a bad personality, yes, but it doesn't mean that everything that is said against him is true as well. So his fatwa is mentioned in the late sources, historical sources, for example, Jawahir al-Kalam fi Sawanhan Ayyam by Ashraf al-Wa'idin and also Al-Alfain. Now, those scholars who have examined this verdict, I mean, what I'm talking about the contemporary researchers, yes, they have come to this conclusion that we cannot find any trace of such a fatwa, of such a verdict in the great authentic sources of the past. I mean, when you're talking about one historical point, we need to find it in the earliest sources. So when something is just mentioned in a source in the 14th century without referring to any other source in the past, in the earliest periods of Islam, the conclusion is that we cannot rely on it.
And whether was it possible to issue something like a fatwa or verdict against Imam of the time?
It is possible, of course.
Was it there? Are there any cases, I mean, of the other ulama who, for example, issued a fatwa? Because saying this and that or paying allegiance is something, but issuing a fatwa from the side of, for example, a judge is something else, brother.
Yeah, when it comes to this case, so we prove that this attribution is wrong. So we cannot attribute this fatwa
at least this fatwa.
Yeah.
But the behavior of Shuraih showed that he was absolutely in the camp of Ubaydullah ibn Ziyad.
That's something for sure. Okay. And we have other cases in the history of Islam. There are some people who are known as the court scholars, so to speak. I mean, unfortunately, in the history of Islam, in some cases, some scholars, so-called religious scholars, are in the service of the oppressive rulers of the time.
Yes.
And in some cases, they are passing judgments against some people just to, justify the, negative and the wicked decisions of the rulers of the time. So it has happened in the history of not only Islam, we can claim that it has happened in the history of many divine religions, that some wicked people who were apparently religious leaders, they helped the oppressive rulers of the time. So this is a reality and we cannot ignore it. Shuraih Qadi, the famous judge, he, had a very bad ending because of the fact
reputation.
That he left Imam al-Husayn alayhi salam. Not only that, he helped the enemy of Imam al-Husayn alayhi salam. But whether he issued this fatwa or not, we cannot prove it because of the fact that, as I mentioned, this is not mentioned by authentic sources.
And compare it to a personality like Hor, that he is among the members of the army of the enemy of Imam al-Husayn alayhi salam. All of a sudden, and in a moment, by the grace of Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala and Imam al-Hussein, he is changed totally, up to an extent that he becomes martyr for Imam al-Hussein. But an old, religiously mature person like Shuraih lost the way, and unfortunately, could not reach salvation. And this is how the grace and the mercy of Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala and the a'imma can overshadow a person and not another one. Thank you very much, Sheikh, for a nice elaboration regarding Shuraih ibn Haris al-Kandi. You gave us really beautiful details about his life and whether he had a role in assassinating Imam al-Hussein alayhi salam or not. It was very kind of you.
My pleasure.
And thank you very much, dear listeners, for listening to us to another episode. God bless you all. Fi amanallah.
Inna fil jannati nahran min laban. إن في الجنة نهرا من لبن لعلي وحسين وحسن لعلي وحسين وحسن إن في الجنة نهرا من لبن إن في الجنة نهرا من لبن لعلي حسين وحسن لعلي وحسين وحسن كل من كان محبا لهم كل من كان محبا لهم يدخل الجنة من غير الحزن يدخل الجنة من غير حزن إن في الجنة نارا من لبن إن في الجنة نارا من لبن علي وحسين وحسن.
American immigrant family.